So, yeah, second lecture about functional programming or the part two of the functional programming. Today's topics are, we are going to talk about monoids a bit more. We are going to go through some examples how to use them and some examples what kind of monoids do you can actually find in the standard libraries. And then we study functors again. So functors is something that you already studied in functional programming one. You saw a few basic functors and you probably know what fmap is, and it's probably quite simple, except that in this course we take some exotic functors which have nice properties and do really different things than functional programming one. Functor is some kind of a container. It contains some elements, and then you can use fmap to change the elements inside the containers. And in this course, functors are really not containers. They might not contain any elements at all, for example. A few notes about the course. I thought I don't need a course web page for this small course. Turns out that I do. I got huge bunch of questions about everything, so I made this course web page where I collect the answers to these questions, so you can check there first if there's something odd. We have the timetable and links to the exercises and whatnot here. How do you pass the course? We, I think, agreed to this last time. So first 4 credits, you complete the exercise I give you. And the 5th credit is the 27-hour exercise work. And final thing that I completely forgot during the first lecture is that I have to give you grades for this course. This is graded from 1 to 5. And, this is something that you can have your say in. This, I have no real incentive to grade you in any specific way. But here's my proposal how to grade you. So basically, you do all the weekly exercises. Each exercise in the weekly exercise set is graded from, nope, doesn't work at all, to honest attempt. I mean, SAMHSA sees that you've actually tried the exercise, and it doesn't really work, but you put an effort in it. Then there's mark for correct, and then there is mark for awesome. You did something that goes beyond the exercise. It's really nice, the thing you did. There are start exercises, which are marked one level higher. So honest attempt to very difficult exercise counts as a correct. And then there is this huge list of, how much you must do each week to get which grade you want. So if you do, get three honest attempts and one correct answer each week, you're done, you get grade one. And if you get 3 correct answers and 3 awesome answers every week, you get grade 5 and cake. That's the basic scale. And you can figure out from this list what you get. Okay? Yes?
If you get the 3 correct and 3 awesome for the most weeks, but you get the 300 and 1 correct for 1 week.
Yeah, the weakest week counts.
Sorry?
The worst week counts. And there's this rule. If you get an awesome out of some exercise, you can convert it into 2 correct answers, and you can patch up the weeks that you failed. So do the star exercises, and you can actually skip whole exercise session even. So you can balance it with these. And other interesting points, if you are late, you submit within 1 week of the deadline, we downgrade one of the exercises one level. So to make you show up at correct time. And if you return more than 1 week late, this is for practical reasons, I don't have slack for doing this. I don't have time to exercise, check your exercises. Then every exercise counts as nope. So if you are more than 7 days late, don't bother. And this is just to make it possible for me and SAMHSA to correct these things. Okay, this is my proposal. And before this is actually enforced, I kind of need you to, slightly accept this. So this is okay. Weakest week counts. Each exercise is graded. Star exercises give you the awesome grades. Awesome grades can be used to patch up bad weeks. And of course, obviously, if you have a reasonable reason to, be late, like you got sick, dumped, your relative got sick, world is treating you very unfairly, some other course has high workload and you got actually get the credits by spending 1 week doing that, then let me know before you are late. I can extend the deadlines. Okay, clear. So, final question. Anyone here who disagrees with this, doesn't like this? Now is your chance to change it. Mild dislike, you don't like it. Yeah, the question translated is 5 is you did everything correctly. Yeah, that's exactly like this. Except that we have this exercise marked with a star, even in the first exercise set. And if you do 1 star, you can, you know, up other grades. So you do the star exercises correctly, and you automatically get this, you know, slack. You can be wrong in other exercises. So it's the whole idea of this thing is make you do the stuff on time and give you quite accurate control of what grade you are going to get. So you work more, you get better grade, and that's it. Unlike exam, which is pretty random. Yeah. Okay, translation. Within 7 days of the deadline, the idea is that I pass out the exercises on Monday, and you return them to SAMHSA during the Tuesday's supervised session next week. So you have from Monday to Tuesday, this is your no penalty time, and from Tuesday to next Tuesday is the 7 days mentioned here. Then you get the small penalty, and after that, you know, we don't accept the exercise anymore.
I thought someone said Wednesday. Yeah.
Wednesday, all right. My bad. So yeah, Wednesday. Yeah, obviously. I think I even mentioned it. Yeah, Wednesday. My mistake. Okay. Is this... And no one is really badly against that. Well, okay, send me an email if you are badly against that, but just don't want to speak out loud here. And we fix this during the next supervised session. But this is my proposal. Okay. Any other administrative stuff? Yes.
Well, about the program, which is the bank project, right?
Yeah.
Can I start working on that already?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. There's some instructions here of how to do it, and so on. So we'll read through those first. Okay, then on topic. So, well, we have lots of stuff during this course, and during the last supervised session, there were some difficulties that were common to all of the people who participated. So we can show a few things here. We can discuss a little bit about the difficult parts here. And first part that was difficult that I observed was this definition. Most people didn't actually know how to read this thing. So what is data non-empty 8? Specifically, what's this smiley face here? That was the big problem. That's just an infix form of a data constructor. For example, you have a normal data constructor like pred or end or max, last, min. Like functions in Haskell, you can have infix functions, you can have infix constructors. So this is just an infix constructor. Think of it like a plus. So let's make an example of how you actually use it. This is actually the worst classroom ever for coding because I have to be bent over all the time. So, if I define something like this, I get a new data type. The data type is constructed using this operator here. And let's make it showable so I can actually show it to you. And how do I construct values like that? Well, let's make a non-empty container of ints. So let's start with 42, and after that we have, yeah, or for symmetry reasons. So this is how you used. So this symbol, it's exactly the same as the in this point of abstraction as this column symbol, which you use to append elements to lists. It's exactly the same kind of thing. The colon is constructor for lists, and this colon bar is constructor for non-empty lists. And yeah, you can make any kind of operator here. You can actually use even this backtick notation here. You can write the constructor between its arguments, like you probably have done in you have used a div operator like this. So this works. And any symbol that you care to use, like if you want to use the plus plus symbol, well, doesn't work, has to start with colon. So this is a valid operator, and then you would use it like this. So nothing special here. And what is non-empty? That's a very nice Haskell data type. For example, if I want to write the function maximum. Maximum in Haskell is Haskell Prelude, it's old function, it's bad. If you ask Haskell to compute maximum of an empty list, let's try. Yeah, breaks. So this is from the 80s, it's really bad idea. Maximum is a so-called partial function. I can't take maximum of empty list. People had only monoids then, they didn't have semigroups, so this is probably because of that. So, the better definition for this, of course, is we can implement like this. It's a bit cheap. So the non-empty data type is used to, you know, make functions non-partial. You actually push the requirement of checking that the list contains more than one element to the user of this function. Let's contrast. This is what we did in the exercise work. This was the functional programming one solution. This was one way of taking a unsafe partial function that might fail sometimes and, you know, make it safe. So check the cases where it fails, return nothing, and otherwise return just and the value. Yeah, this is probably clear. Only problem with this is that actually kind of hard to use, because every time you try use this, you have to use case and, you know, pick out it. Handle the case where it's nothing, the value. So even if you are writing a program and you actually know that the list that you are taking the maximum of is never empty, for example, you always add one element to that list, you still have to use the case statement to check if the result is nothing. Whereas this person using the non-empty argument, it always works, but to call that, you actually have to have a non-empty list. So you have to have a, you know, some element and potentially non-empty list at hand. So this allows you to, if you know that the list that you are taking the maximum of is always non-empty, you can actually use this non-empty data type, and then your maximum function is both safe, it doesn't fail, and it doesn't return you the nasty maybe that you have to pick apart using a case statement. So it allows you to record how you view the world is going to be when you program a small thing. Okay, that's the non-empty. Clear enough. You'll try to use it in your program, so at least a little bit. It's a fun guy. Okay, enough of this. Any questions? Clear enough. Yeah. Okay, boring guy, but, you know, useful. Do you have any other difficult parts in the exercise that you already encountered? Because if you have questions, it's, you know, nice for me to answer them. Everyone is okay with this.
There was like maybe a bit more explanations to, like, for me at least, this map thing was pretty, although there was the bits from data map, but still.
Yeah, okay.
Had a lot of data structures in the first course.
Yeah, the whole
end of.
Yeah, those two are, you know, part of my lecture, but I was slow on Monday. So they will appear very soonish when we get to this topic. And we get to this topic if we start and get on use that. Oh, well. Yeah. If there's no other questions, we basically answer your question in depth. Okay. First, we want to go through monoids again, show you more examples how to use them, and a few more monoids that you can use. So let's make one use case, how you use monoids in a real life. And this is Samsa's example, and it involves program configuration. Let's imagine that we are writing a program that crawls the internet and checks if web pages in certain server are up. So your server is running, or it goes to, you know, my functional programming web page and checks if every page is around. This software, when you run it, requires configuration. It requires configuration like where are the web pages that it's going to try to check if they are there. How many times is it going to check? Is it enough to, for the first attempt to load the web page to fail? Then you can have other configuration like is the output nicely colored, or how you print the output of this program. So basically you had this program like check web page, and you give it page URL, and then it goes there and tries to load all the pages and sees it and checks if all the links are correct and things like this. So to model the parameters for this program, you have usually some record type that you use to slam in all the bits and details of your program. It can contain fields like use color. Do you want the user of this program get colored output or not? And it's probably any. I choose any there. We'll soon check whether this makes sense or not, and what any actually is. Base URL. Let's use monoid last, or last string, as a first approximation of this. The string is obviously the URL. And number of retries, how many times you try. Well, yeah, this is something like, I think, last int. Okay, what are these things? Well, you have to implement them in your exercises, but we can check how they work. Let's use this. So I can get the code and GHI at the same time. First, the info command is very useful. So what is the any in the in my use color thing? It's a any. It contains a boolean. The whole idea is that if I have an expression or composition of monoids containing anys, it's going to check if any of these composed or map-ended booleans is true. So it's basically like a monoid for the AND operation. So idea is that if at any point when I'm invoking my program, I ask it to use color, it will use color. Okay, what is last? Last is this fun thing from, you know, way back. It's actually not a monoid. It's supposed to be a monoid by using a nested maybe. It's usually a semi-group, but it works like this. Last, let's take numbers. Any guesses what this is going to return? Yeah. It picks up the last non-nothing value that it has seen. That's very simple. Meaning that if I build my configuration upon that, it means that, yeah, if I set the base URL multiple times, the last invocation of the base URL is the thing that I want. And a retries, it's also last. Then, let's make this a monoid. And since all the fields are monoids, it's very easy thing to do. It's actually nasty to write. I mean, you just type and you don't have to think about anything. It's just, you know, boilerplate. There are actual tools that, you know, write code like this for you, but, you know, usually not worth the bother. And let's use the operator form for the mconcat or mapend. Yeah. Now if I have two configurations, one, let's say I read from some base configuration file in my file system and other set of configuration I get from the user, I know how to combine these. If any of these guys wants me to use color, it's either configured in the system-wide configuration or the user asks for it, then I get colored output. So, how do I use this? Well, this allows me to bit abuse the Haskell record update syntax. And let's make a config value example of how I would turn this into this slightly minor DSL. You know, not the most stupid domain-specific language ever, the one that allows you to easily write configuration files. So let's make a configuration file. This is the base config that says that we always want to use color, and we have 10 retries. This is something that is the, let's say, the default values for my program. This is what I always use if the user doesn't specify anything. So I can do it like this. I take the empty config that doesn't specify anything. Then I mapend, let's say, another configuration. Well, which is the empty configuration with the exception that I use this, set the color on. And then me to write code like this. You can consider this as, you know, most primitive domain-specific language for specifying configuration files within Haskell source code. Of course, I can give names to these things. I can have this, let's say, obviously, then I can, you know, clean this up a bit, because, you know, the adding pad doesn't ever change the thing. And I can, you know, build up bigger and bigger config files by just appending, let's use base URL also. Like this. Allows for very easy configuration. You can have partial configurations that you can smash together. You have, consider a bigger program with more configuration options. You can write program modes using this. One is the colored output mode, then you combine it with the persistent mode, there's huge number of retries or whatever. And let's check if I... Yeah, of course. Yeah, need the monoid instance. Yeah, like this. If I have multiple bits of information, I can combine. This is one example. Okay, then more interesting stuff. Let's talk about monoids in general, Haskell programming in general for a slight bit. If you ever have a construction like a monoid or functor or whatever, there are a few dimensions that you probably want to analyze it with. Firstly, during the last lecture, we saw that if we have two monoids, you can use pairs to combine them. Obviously, you want to check what happens if you use the opposite of a pair in either. Does that have anything interesting to do with a monoid? With monoids, turns out it's not interesting. And finally, one thing that is always interesting is that is a function instance of these things. For example, is a ordinary function a monoid? Well, I have no idea how to make function like A to B into a monoid. What does it mean to, slam together two arbitrary functions. However, if the result type of a function is a monoid, then the function itself is a monoid. This is actually a really clever thing to do. And it works like this. So, if I have function from A to M, where M is a monoid, what is the empty thing here? Well, the obvious choice is to have a function that, no matter what it's given, returns you M empty. This is probably the safest bet for neutral element. Then, if I append two of these functions together, well, what can I do? Only thing I can do with the function is to supply it with an argument. And first result, I apply first function. Yeah, now I have two results from both of the functions. And what do I want to do with them? Append the results together. So basically, a function returning a monoid is mappendable. It's also a monoid. This is useful in cases. It's also defined in the base library, so I can't actually execute my definition due to conflicting instances. But let's see what this actually gets for us. Obviously, if I have function like let's say something from strings to sums of ints. So a function f1, which is something like this, and it takes a string and sums the length of the string. Okay, any other sums that I can get from string? Well, I can, you know, take some kind of substrings. Yeah, okay. I have two functions that take strings and return sums. The other one got a bit generic type, but anyways, works for strings. And then I can do silly stuff like this. So basically, it lifts to, you know, allows me to, you know, first compute the result for f1 for this string, then the result f2, and then monoidally combine these. It allows you to do really strange stuff like this. Actually works. Have a few minutes of your life figuring out what it actually does. So let's make a useful example of this. So let's take an example of sorting stuff. And we have this sort by function that you all know and love. Allow you to specify a ordering. You want, you know, order values by, you know, this function. Use is something like this. Now let's sort by, then I need function that is taking two elements and returning ordering. Compare is the obvious candidate. Compare is basically using the normal order for any data type. So works like this. Compare is a nice function. You can apply it like this. It gives you the normal ordering. You can use this flip function, which is basically it takes a function and supplies the parameters in opposite order. And you can use this to get sort that sorts the list in the opposite order easily. You don't have to reverse it there. Then if we define a small auxiliary function called on, which is basically function kind of function composition for two parameter functions. Looks like this. F is a two-parameter function, and g is some kind of modifier for the parameters. Looks like this. So basically calls f, but applies g to the arguments of f. Allows me to write code like use it on infix form. Sort these numbers on, you know, by their absolute value. So, you know, bigger numbers regarding if they have minus or plus get put last on the list. And yeah. Now, what can I do with this? Let's suppose that I have a more difficult comparing strategy in mind. I want to order them by absolute value. All the numbers must be ordered by the absolute value. But if there are two numbers that have the same value, I want the negative numbers first. You know, why not? It's one easy thing to do. I can do like this. And this is something that, you know, should be giving you the feeling of what just did happen. Why can I even write this? Why can I even, you know, compare on apps? It's a two-parameter function. My instance for functions as monoids is just one arrow. Why can I apply it on two-parameter functions? Any ideas? Why is this same as this? Why can I even, do things like this? Any guesses? This is a kind of a thing that you have to, learn to think about when you're writing Haskell in this course. Well, obviously, this is a function from A into functions from A to ordering. And functions from A to ordering, these are obviously monoids, since ordering is probably a monoid. So this part is a monoid. So if we set M to be this part here, then, this M, this part, that's a monoid. Then we add A in front of that. That's also a monoid. So it turns out that our instance here works for functions of any arity. They can take any number of parameters that you want if they end up producing a monoid at the end. And now, ordering has to be a monoid. And ordering is basically picking up, these are basically the rules how the ordering monoid works. If it gets equal, few elements are equal, then the result is equal. If we have an equal and greater than, or equal and less, or less than, then it's going to pick something that is not the equal. And if it gets opposite answers, it's going to use the first one. So. So pick the result of the first comparison. If one of them is not giving you any information, then use the other one. So how does this work? I get a function. First, compare on apps. It's going to return me a comparison that compares things with absolute value. Compare is going to give me the ordinary compare. Then when I execute this monoidal composition of these two functions, I get a function that compares with the strategy that if it gets two elements that are actually equal based on this first part, then it's going to use the result of the second part. Again, thing that you really need to experiment a little bit with before getting, but it's nice. I can, expand this however far I want. Okay, anything more about this? Questions at this point? Fun with monoids, advanced fun with monoids.
I would like to ask about where you made the colored config over there.
Yeah.
So how, understand why can you say that, like how does it know that it's going to be it is going to have the type of config, because you never specify you don't use it like a value constructor there.
Okay, so how it works, it's M empty, it's any monoid, then it's going to be a record. This is the record update syntax. It's basically saying to take this record and modify it using this rule. And in Haskell we have this limitation that, is beneficial for this one single case. It says that I can't have this same field in more than one data type. So useColor, only config has the field useColor. So it's fixed like this. And this is probably a bad choice in Haskell's part, because then if I make another config that has also the useColor field, I have to write useColor2 or config2 useColor, or give it a different name. Not very fun. Okay. Mormonoids. I'm afraid that I am going to be so slow that we don't get to the end of this lecture either. But I think this is fun stuff. Then there was this other question. What is this monomap construct? So, let's use the data map module. How many of you are passingly familiar with data.map? Tried this at some point? Yeah, a few. How many of you who didn't show your hands are familiar with dictionary structures in any programming language? C# probably has them. Python also has them. It's basically a mapping from some keys to some values. Like a phone book, associates names with phone numbers. That sort of thing. So, let's make this, and this is my absolute favorite monoid. It's very useful for stuff that I do. So I have a map that maps keys k into values a, and it's wrapped inside this new type constructor. And of course, since we are talking about monoids, maps are monoids. So basically, if you have a phone book of Sweden and phone book of Finland, you can, you know, glue them together and you have a phone book of Sweden and Finland. So these are obviously monoids. You have to reorder the pages to get the order correct, but basically like this. And this is actually kind of like the basic instance of, you know, functions. It's a mapping from K to A, and it's monoid if the value that it maps to is a monoid. M empty, well, it's an empty map. Or let's write like, yeah, empty map. Map end, well, I have two maps. I have to combine these maps. Obviously, I can't remember everything, so I have to go in and look the documentation of how this actually is supposed to work. And where do I have it? Data map. Let's use a strict map. And it has all these functions ready made. If I have two maps, I can merge them somehow. One way of merging them is just take two maps, and if there are duplicate keys, same name in both phone books, just pick the first one. Or you can have your own custom rule for picking the keys. So let's do that. So combine two phone books. If they both contain the same name, then use MapEnd to cross the results together. So you get two phone numbers listed in the new phone. Let's see if I typoed this very badly. Yeah, obviously, if I'm going to union two maps, the maps need ordered keys. Need this ord constraint. Okay, cool. So, this is my favorite data analysis tool. You know, monoids, normal data analysts don't seem to have much in common. I have an example problem that I'm going to show using this construct. Consider a situation. You have a long-running web service, or you know, whatever machine control system, like a web server or whatever device like this, and then the web server catches on fire and burns down, you know, physically explodes or, you know, gets wiped off the planet Earth for some reason. And all you have left is the log files of this web server. And you have to, you know, somehow reconstruct what was the state of the web server. Or we have some kind of system control thing. We have this control machine that switches on devices in our big automated factory and switches them off when needed. And then that thing burns down, and all you have is the log files. And you want to reconstruct the log files. So let's use this as an example. I have let's use the factory example. It's a bit shorter to write. I have events. My log file consists of these event data types. We have different machines that have logged some events. And then we have actual events. This is basically simplest example I can type during the lecture. I have a log of, you know, machines turning on and off again. And from this log, I must, you know, deduce which machines are going to be on. And log file, let's make a constant list for this. Machine A is going to power on. Machine B is going to be powering on. And A is going to be shut down again. So now I have to figure out which of these machines are on and which of them are off. Imagine that this list contains a million elements, so it's not obvious that B is on and A is off. So how do I write code like this? Well, that's actually extremely trivial thing to do. So first, we want somehow to project the essential data out of this event file. So let's make a list that contains these monmap thingies. Let's map each of these events into this monoidal map. Well, the map that we are going to make contains just one key value pairing. So we have we have the key, which is the machine ID, and then we have last what do you call it? Pretty complex, but you can, of course, make helper functions to make this bit cleaner. So, what have I done here? This function takes each of these events here and maps them into singleton dictionaries, phone books that contain just one entry. And the key for looking up these entries is the machine ID, and the entry is the monoid last that we saw just a few minutes ago, containing the actual event. So it picks up the last event of the current machine. And this thing here, well, it's a monmap, so it's a monoid. Yeah. And if I have list full of monoids, I can mconcat them and and this allows me to pick up, you know, the current state of the machines. Easy. One line, no loops, no nothing. Fun thing is, of course, that you can nest mon maps, so you can make nested maps if you have need for that. Or we could use some other monoid here. For example, we want to know how many times someone has push the power button in a single machine. And one parenthesis there. Yeah. You should really write, you know, give names to parts of this big expression. It's too much for me to handle at least. And if I change the monoid inside the map, I can get number of times people have been pressing the power buttons in the machines. So this forms a generic pattern. This is something that gets used so often that it has a name. It's called fault map, which is basically you first map with something, then you concat the results. Very useful, very useful. You can partition data, you can summarize data. Extremely fun thing to use for many, many purposes. Okay. That's probably enough of the monoids. Yeah. Fault map is a bit more general than mconcat and map. It's actually type class of its own. Any questions about monoids? This is probably all that I have to say about monoids. Did I leave anything interesting out? Did you ask about endo?
Yes, I did.
Okay, let's do one more monoid. I like monoids. So.
My comment was just that I did figure it out, there wasn't much explanation in the exercises. So yeah. that was my comment. I don't need you to go through.
Yeah, okay, I can, well, I can supply you the context for endo.
Okay.
So, what he's talking about is this functor like this. It's a function from one A to the same A. Endo function, hence the name. It's endo means from itself to itself. And the idea is that this is, of course, monoid through composition of these functions. If you have two functions from A to A, just apply the first function, take the result, and give it to the second function. So map end AB is exactly A dot B. Okay, what is the reason for this? What are the uses for this thing? Why do we want that thing? Besides completeness, that you can specify monoid instances for it and do it like this. Consider this. I had this fold map construct. This is actually defined in standard libraries. Unlike this mconcat and map, it works for almost all containers in Haskell. It works for other things than lists. And it basically gives me the fold map instance. Allows me to map things into monoids and cross them into a single value, which means that it's not very general function. For example, if I want a fold, ordinary fold L function, I can do other things than associative things. Monoids are always associative. So I can't have thing like, let's say, like this. I can't make these sequences of subtractions, because if you reparenthesize subtraction, you get no different result or division. These are non-monoidal operators. So if I get this fold map and I want to do, let's say, this chain fraction with it, then how can I do this? Well, I want mconcat map something like this. I want to implement this using this mconcat and map structure. Why do I want to do this? Because I have the fold map that works identically and is defined for any data structure, so it would apply to everywhere else. But, you know, I would need a non-associative monoid, which I shouldn't write because it's bad practice. So what I can write instead is endo. I can take these endo functions, which divide things. I get I didn't think this the wrong sense. So yeah, well. Yeah. Yeah, like this. Yeah, okay. Sorry about the, you know, confusion that I had. Happens to you in the exercise sessions, I'm sure, as well. So instead of, you know, doing this mconcat and map with the badly formed monoid, I can use endo to actually wrap any function that I want. I get endo A. The way of extracting values out of endo is this app endo, which picks out the function from inside the endo. So I can use app endo, I pick out the function from inside the result, and then I apply to number 10. And I think I did the order wrong. The associativity wasn't the way I decided, but it works like this. So if you have something that is some mathematical operation, it's really not a monoid, then you can wrap it inside of endo, use this mconcat and map construction to construct you a huge function, which you then execute later on, which actually does this transformation. Yeah. This is the reason why we have endos. Pretty complex, but there's one exercise in the exercise set that you can try this out with. Okay, phew. That's monoids then. Any more questions? No. Let's have 5 minutes of break so I can catch my breath and continue with functors. So 20 past, we start working on functors. Okay, cool. Yeah. Would it be offensive for you if I sat down? Because typing with this keyboard solo is going to cramp my back sooner or later. So my voice is going to be less loud if I sit down. But okay, topic for the later part of this lecture is the extended functor family. So you know what is a functor from FP1. And now we are going to get more things that are a bit like functors, but not quite. And the agenda is that we go through them by name. We first see what they are, and then we figure out a few examples from the each. So the extended functor family, of course, the most efficient and best and, you know, all-around awesome player in this family is the ordinary functor, basically defined like So basically functor, it allows you to map with A structure. So basically if F is a list, this is your ordinary map function. F can be pretty much anything. For example, if I F map with plus one, adds plus one to any element inside the functor, it can be add one to every element of the list. If I have maybe, it adds, goes into the maybe structure, adds 10. If I have, you know, function that is multiplying things by 10, I can go in to this function and modify the result type. It gives me a function, and let's give an argument to the function, let's say start with 5. And it multiplies it with 10 and adds 1. So you can modify the result. Also very useful for modifying the result type. For example, I can take this function which is operating on numbers and make the return type be a string instead of a number. Very useful for fitting different functions together. This is the functor, and it has two laws. So, these are the laws. If you fmap with identity function, it doesn't change anything. So you fmap with function that does nothing, it's equivalent of doing nothing. Meaning that the functor can't change the structure inside which the values are. It can't go and drop elements from the list or add new elements to the list. Also, the second law, which is always true because of Haskell type system, and the first law, is that if you first map with G, and then you fmap with F, it's the same as fmapping with the composition of F and G. F.G means function that first does G and passes the result to F. So these are the laws. And the laws basically say that this is a sensible thing. It doesn't really change the structure or hide any... Doing an fmap will return exactly the same shape of the data. Only the values inside of your structure may change. It also can't hide additional information into this structure. It can't count how many times it's been fmapped overall. It can't do anything like this. It's the obvious thing to do. So it's easy to reason about. It doesn't do anything tricky. It's a simple guy. This is the base layer of the applicative Monad stack that we are learning. But let's see the other members of the family. We have a class called contravariant, meaning contravariant functors, which is basically exactly the same as original functors, but we do this trick here, we reverse the order of arguments here. So if I have a function that converts B's to A's, and structure containing A's, I can get a structure containing B's. How neat is that? I can, it's like a reversing function. This needs an immediate example. Lists and maybes are functors, but what is a contravariant functor? Any examples that come to mind? That would behave that if I give you a means of converting B to an A, and structure containing an A's, and you give me back structure containing B's. Do they even exist? No.
Should the app A and B be reversed as well?
No. That's a trick. Okay. So, I can convert B to A, and then I get an A, and it gives me a B back. It's not as complex as you think. Here is an example. Function that takes A as an argument that returns a boolean. For example, this is a contravariant functor. Anything where the A, the type parameter A, appears on the negative position or on the left of the function arrow, that's likely to be a contravariant. So what does it mean for this to be contravariant? Let's have auxiliary function, we can try things. So, test that everything works. So this is a predicate, takes ints, and I can run this predicate, and I can give it int 10 or int 11. Yeah. Now, suppose that instead of these ints, I have strings. So, this is basically what the contravariant allows me to do. So predicate is contravariant. Contramap, I get the function from B's to A's. I get pred B, and then what do? Okay, we are going to make a small digression here. How many of you that well, now looking at my whiteboard, is this obvious? How many of you think that it's obvious what goes on where my cursor is right now? Not obvious at all. And totally not obvious. Okay, yeah. Well, what do we do when we have this abstract code, which is not obvious in Haskell? This is even a greater feature in other languages like Idris or Agda or PureScript, but Haskell has this in a rudimentary form. We type in underscore, and let's see. Underscore is called a hole. It's basically, you type it there, it says to the compiler, I have to write something here, but I don't know what I am going to write. Please help me. And the error message here is the help that you get. You have to put a predicate B here. And I have B, which is this function, and F, which is this other kind of function, and then I could probably make infinite recursion with the contramap. So how do I get the predicate? Well, pred is the constructor. You know, I can use pred to make predicates. Reload. Now I have to replace this underscore with a function from B to bool. And I have function from B to A, and I have function from A to bool. Gee, that's difficult. Well, those are the two parts that I need to use. So let's say, I don't know how to do this. I put the underscore here. Underscore, I can use it as a function. It's a great idea. I can put this underscore here. Then I know that my components, the result is going to be composed of F and B somehow. I don't know how. Please tell me, how do I compose them? And yeah, it says that I have this big hole here. Says that, okay, you have first part is like this, the second part is like this. And then you get the third part that is like this. Okay, in this case, doesn't help because my compiler is a bit too old. Newer compilers would have told me that you probably want to use the function composition operator. But basically, this should be obvious from FP1. Yeah, if you happen to, you know, permutate the answers, permutate your expressions when you are working with these, it's completely normal. Now, red is a contravariant. So what happens if I contramap my is-even predicate? So let's say, okay, what can I even use as a function here? B to an int. So I have to have something that converts anything to an int. Well, yeah, read. Read is a nice function. Read converts strings into Haskell values. Doesn't do it very smartly, but does do it. So now I have a string predicate. This is a predicate that associates Boolean values with strings. Yeah, this is the contramap. It allows you to change kind of a thing that is a bit like an argument for a function. This is nice. This is works completely opposite to your intuition. Predicates are useful types. All programs contain some form of predicates. Probably not as a new type, but still. Okay, another example, quickly, because this is so weird. Remember the sorting example, where we had this compare function. These are also contravariants. Remember, we had to use this on thingy here, this weird combinator here. Turns out that this is actually contramap for these ordering types or comparison types. Let's just write it out quickly. So, basically, it's the same as the definition of the on there. So this allows me to do the on trick by using a more general machinery. So everything that has is some kind of a function, contramap modifies the input of this function. Functor modifies the output of the function. Then we have this simple thing. I think contravariants are relatively exotic. And what are the laws for contravariant before I continue? Basically, the laws are the same as functor. And it doesn't do anything differently. The arguments are just flipped around. Then we have bifunctor. Bifunctor is a useful guy. It doesn't appear so often in Haskell code, but it's very, very nice when you actually find the use case for it. It is functor which has two type arguments. So we have let's rename them, it's easier to read. F like from, T like to. Yeah, it's bimap. It's a function that, it's a thing that has two type variables, and you map over both of them. Okay, quick examples. Pairs. Pairs are obviously bifunctors. Yeah. Forgot how to Haskell during the weekend. So this is a type constructor for pairs. So this means pairs are bifunctors, hopefully. And this is a really obvious thing. It will be useful at the end of the course. Or any other bifunctors. Pretty much any ordinary type with two type parameters as a bifunctor. Let's do one more. Either is a bifunctor. Everyone remembers what is either. It's left some error, right some real value. So basically, you know, this allows you to map both branches of your either at the same time. Useful if your program produces an either where the one part is an error message, the other part is the real result. And you are, say, presenting these results to the user. So you do something like bimap show show, convert both branches into strings, for example. Okay. Bifunctors are somewhat useful. There's of course trifunctors, quadfunctors, and whatever, but I have never seen them live, so probably. And then we have the weirdest functor of them all, which is actually makes me laugh. And you know, bifunctor laws, it has to have functor laws for both components, left and right. Profunctor, yeah, it has a die map, which is also a thing that takes two mapping functions. And hopefully I get this correct. It's kind of like using a normal function and contravariant functor, normal functor and contravariant functor together. So this is really a strange guy. We are going to talk about this guy hopefully during the last few lectures. And basically, what is this thing? This is kind of like if something is a profunctor, you have to have ways to modify some kind of an argument, some kind of a result. So these are function-like things. They might not be real functions, but they are something a bit like functions, like pipeline parts, something that converts values from here into values of this kind of a class. Obviously, ordinary functions like you know functions from anything to anything. Yeah, you can. Let's actually leave this for future reference. We'll do it later on, but I'm running out of time during this lecture to do it. Anything that's like function, and I have a typo here that I'm too tired right now to figure out. These are the crazy stuff. These are the fun stuff that we are going to build upon. Mostly this ordinary functor. Okay. Any questions about these guys except the last one that I always get wrong? You can Google it and get the right result. Y-functor, very easy guy. Contravariant functor, something that you probably haven't thought about. And then the normal functor. So we have 10 minutes, I think, left. Anyone in a hurry to escape before that? No. Let's make let's try to do something that is not going to work in 10 minutes, but let's begin it anyways. Let's make a random number generator in Haskell in 10 minutes. Let's make a basic pseudo-random number generator called linear congruential generator, which is thing that makes you picks up random numbers. You can make a thing that decides a randomly where your character is going to go in a game or makes lottery numbers for you. And this is turns out that this is a functor. This is kind of a functor. And the idea is that we have this mysterious mathematical formula that updates some value and you get a random result as a result of that. So let's make new type, which is RNG. And basically this is, let's make a function. Linear congruential generator, which is basically previous state, the x1 plus n, and then you get a multiplied by the previous one plus some c, mod sum m. Yeah, that's your basic random number generator. If you need very low quality random numbers, that's how you do it. And then you have these constants that figure out how your generator is going to work. You have some magic values that make it behave nicely. Yeah. Okay, you pick out the wrong values, you get worse random numbers. And the m is 2 to the power of 20. 32, meaning that if I compute this using 32-bit integers or words or whatever, it's going to automatically truncate for me. Yeah. Now, let's make a fun functor out of this. A random mutator, it's taking an A and, somehow, even more simple, let's make a random A. That's our functor, it's more simple than the mutator one. A random thing is, it's going to be a function from the state of the random number generator into a new value. And since this is an A, so A is the random value that we are going to generate. This is the thing that makes random values of type A. Idea is that the word 32, that's the state of the linear congruential generator. So that's the seed where we pick up the random values. And for example, we have basic make 32-bit integers random number generator, which is basically it applies this linear congruential generator to the seed value, gets a few, mixes it up with the multipliers, stuff like that, then returns that as the random number that we want, and then updates the seed of this random number generator so that the next random number will be different, and returns that as well. Here is my random number generator. It's going to produce me a... Oh, I'll have to have... pick out the correct element of there. This gives me pseudo-random numbers. Okay, this is how you do all your basic simulations and whatever games. You need a random behavior for your opponents. Question is, if I want something else than in, you know, 32-bit integer as my random result. Well, obviously, if random is a functor, then I can supply fmap, which is basically modifying the result of the computation, and like this. Okay, what did I do wrong? Try to do things too fast and you get really strange code. Probably going to do this again during the next lecture. That was a ridiculous example because I'm trying to do it too fast. But now, let's have this random number generator. Now I can generate, for example, random strings containing numbers. Obviously, you can replace the show with something reasonable that's actually going to generate the kind of random number thing you want. A random player character in your game, random seed for your cryptography or whatever. So this is, you know, the first interesting functor, and I just had to rush it through for this lecture so we can get a head start in the next one. Okay, quickly, any questions? Anything bothering you at this point? This part, you are allowed to feel confused about that one. We'll fix that during next lecture. But those are the things that we have. Did I forget anything essential? Probably not. No questions, nothing. Well, okay. Let's figure out what these things actually are during the next lecture. And that's it for today.